The Spirit of Invention in Maine. Maine has a history of innovation and invention. The microwave, earmuffs, and a version of today's snowmobile. The 19th century's most successful female inventor came from Maine. Helen Blanchard filed for her first patent for a sewing machine that could sew a zigzag stitch. She also came up with the crank pencil sharpener. Today, Maine inventors span many fields, from medical devices to truck parts. We'll talk with some of the people who've had a light bulb moment and turned it into a tangible device that makes our lives better, safer, or maybe just a little easier. We'll learn about how an invention goes from the idea stage to patenting to financing to delivery. And we want to hear from you. Do you have an idea that you think might earn you a place on the list of Maine inventors? Maine Calling is next. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. There's something about the frontier tradition and creative energy here in Maine that might just feed into a spirit of invention. There have been many inventors from Maine, and the tradition continues today. We'll learn about some of those inventions and what it takes to turn them into a reality. Joining me in our studio, Mac McIntyre. He's the inventor of Elsa, a convertible bag and vest, which we will hear more about in just a little bit. He's part owner and product developer at Martinson Industries in Portland. Sean Sweeney is a patent attorney with the law firm Tredecum. And Don Gooding is chief content officer at Four Colors of Money for Entrepreneurs, a company that helps entrepreneurs finance their projects. And as always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever had an idea for an invention but really weren't sure where to start? Do you have any questions about how to get a patent? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Don Gooding, we'll start with you. Why is Maine... What is it about Maine? Is there something in the air, I guess, that that makes it a good place or a breeding ground for invention?
Well, there's the aphorism, necessity is the mother of invention. And I think here in Maine, there are lots of people who are trying to make it on their own, and they're faced with all sorts of necessities, and they have to invent their way out of solving problems because there really is no other way around.
And so, and this is just the way of life that's sort of inducive to problem solving and invention.
Yes, and you know the Yankee ingenuity is certainly a tradition throughout New England, but also there's a certain sense of self-reliance that they're not going to look to others to solve the problems, that they're going to figure out how to solve it themselves. And so that has lent itself to a long tradition of everyone from tinkerers who are coming up with useful niche inventions in their garage or their basement, to companies like L.L. Bean that was founded on, you know, an essential invention of a great boot, but then have gone on to build a great business that goes well beyond that invention.
So, and as we said at the top, there are these historically, there are these inventions that have been significant from Mainers. Earmuffs, we all know about. The sealed diving suit. The machine gun, Hiram Maxim, credited for that. And even John Ruggles from my own town of Thomaston, who is considered the father of the U.S. Patent Office. He was an attorney, judicial Supreme Court justice and senator, and he sort of gave shape to what the U.S. patent system would be and held the very first patent. So historically, we do have this tradition. But Sean, though, this spirit, I guess, still lives on today, right? There are entrepreneurs, inventors getting patents for some of their inventions.
Yeah, there absolutely are. There are a lot of people. Everyone has a problem that they find in their life. And here in Maine, often the solution to that problem lies within yourself. So you come up with a way, a device, in order to solve some problem that's nagging at you. And that is often the birthplace of an invention.
How difficult is it, though, to – so you have this idea. How difficult is it to get a patent? What's the first step?
Well, the first step is usually to determine whether or not what you have is new, whether someone has come up with your idea before. We often will identify a solution to a problem, but we haven't fully looked to see whether someone else has already come up with a solution to that problem. And so we refer to that as a search, a patent search.
And so I invent a device that turns lima beans into chocolate. I'm going to come to you to help me do that search?
I'm usually a point of contact for that. Some people will come to me. They'll have done that search themselves. The patent office has resources where you can search existing patents. That's often a good place to start. If you're in a specific field, sometimes trade magazines or other publications can be another good place to start.
And it may just be that you think you have this idea, no one has it, but someone else does. Can you change it slightly and get a patent, or what's the gamesmanship there?
The gamesmanship, I wouldn't necessarily call it that. You can absolutely find something that takes what you've done and creates something that we refer to as novel. You can add different components to it, and you can find a slightly different way of doing things. You need to make sure that what you've created is not obvious in light of what someone else has done. That's sort of the second stage of the inquiry.
And I assume there's a cost to it, so it has to be worth it as well. You might have invented something that no one else had, but if it's not going to pay off, what's the cost of getting a patent?
The cost of getting a patent can vary widely, but it is not insignificant. You're looking at several thousands of dollars in order to get an application on file. Application filing is usually just the tip of the iceberg. People will look at whether they want to protect here in the United States, whether they want to go internationally. And then once you've made that decision and actually acquired a patent, there's then additional expenses if you're going to enforce it.
Mac McIntyre, tell us about ELSA. What is it?
ELSA was I didn't wake up one morning and say I'm going to invent something today. So it kind of evolved from this necessity, like everybody's saying, we needed something here. And in the line of work I was in, I had a lot of equipment, a lot of gear. When I say gear, it's like tactical equipment, belts, harnesses, and stuff that I wanted to make something that made my life simpler just for me. And it was where, you know, if I had was immersed in the gear industry, knew a lot of it out there, and I was pretty familiar with what existed and what didn't already. So I did a lot of searching just by being immersed in it and knew that, hey, it wasn't out there. So I put things together and kind of Frankenstein this thing for myself and started to show it to other people. And they're like, hey, you know, there's other people that would like that too. So for me, it was like, okay, I guess you're right. So it started to snowball into personal necessity to, hey, other people want that. And it was it's basically a bag that turned the inside of a bag into the exterior of a garment. So the inside of a bag, a backpack, would unfold on itself, and now it's the exterior of whatever you needed, whether it was first aid equipment or what have you, that it was real discovery of patching stuff together. You know, and being a Mainer, I've always said, hey, that's a good backpack. I'm not throwing it out.
So it allow you to does this allow that other backpacks don't have, I guess, giving the audience a sense of?
It does, and it worked for us because, you know, when I want something, I want it to be there every time and not to be kind of, you know, disturbed. So like my hunting vest, I put everything in there, never touch it. I never go in the middle.
Unload it and load it.
Oh, let me go grab that flashlight. I know there's a flashlight there. Don't touch it. So this kind of encapsulated everything to know that, hey, what I needed is going to be here at the moment I needed it. So it would unfold on itself, encapsulated when it was needed. It was there,
and you could install these pods or separate
configurations and way you wanted to attach pockets. You know, if you wanted certain stuff here for one day, and well, maybe I'm going to be doing a different activity, I could put things in different orientation for that activity, or just have a separate one completely for that activity. But you knew you had everything there.
All right, we'll talk more about your experience in getting this developed. Right now, we're going to go to the. A guest is joining us now by phone, Caitlin Shane. She works at Unum and invented a device that helps people with impaired vision. Thanks for calling in, Caitlin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
So you won the Student Innovation Award at the University of New England for your invention. Can you tell us what it is and what it does?
Nope, absolutely. So that's kind of where everything initially started for the business. But it kind of goes back further into my senior year at the University of New England. I was a pre-occupational therapy student, and during one of my clinical rotations, I had noticed that the majority of the children that I was working with who have special disabilities had low vision and had the specific diagnosis of cortical visual impairment. So what I did was during my senior year, I essentially composed what is now my invention and my prototype, which incorporates current occupational therapy techniques to increase the visual acuity, which will hopefully impact those under the age of 25, so mainly focusing on pediatrics. So how it kind of works is it is similar to rebuilding neurons in the brain. If, let's say, you had a stroke. You go to physical therapy, you learn how to, you know, use your arm again. So it's essentially the same approach with using current visually stimulating techniques to rebuild neurons around damaged brain tissue. So that way these people who do not have vision will be able to start to see and become educated and become literate. Mm.
So where are you now? What stage are you at in the development of this, the patenting of it?
So I have filed both the provisional and the non-provisional patent. I have done market research. I also have the prototype developed as well. So kind of where I'm at this point in time is doing probably a small case study and doing work with potentially a university to prove that the device does work. We are not sure at this time if the device would be applicable for treating other types of neurodegeneration, such as Alzheimer's, but that is to be determined at this time. So it's just kind of figuring out the next steps of the research phase.
Okay. Any advice for budding inventors out there?
Absolutely. There's a lot of different avenues, and I feel like, you know, each inventor needs to understand their market. And I know that's something that has obviously been discussed prior, but really understanding the market, what the potential is, how can you make it grow, but also really understanding the types of resources that are there. I know that in the state of Maine, there's a lot of different resources in regards to NTI, and there's a lot of other different types of funding, such as NIH, which I think the more you get involved in your project, the more you'll find if it's going to be valid and how much it's going to be worth in the end. So networking is definitely key.
All right. Caitlin, thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Caitlin Shane invented a device to help people with vision impairment. Let's stay on the theme of funding, Don. She's mentioning a few sources there, but this is obviously an important part.
Absolutely. And in fact, I was on the phone this morning with the folks at Maine Technology Institute, MTI, that she mentioned, and they are, in fact, a great resource to help companies at the very earliest of stages, getting up to $5,000 to do research on the market and up to $25,000 to work on these inventions, these new technologies. And in addition, they do help companies apply. She referred to NIH. That's National Institutes of Health. There's a federal grant program set aside for small businesses called SBIR. And there's a resource. Her name is Karen West. She works with MTI to help companies apply for these federal grants. And for the kind of invention that she was talking about, it's perfect. And you can get $230,000 is the typical grant size. And that's just one of the many colors of money, as I talk about. There are angel investors. Maine Angels is here in Maine. But bootstrapping, using your own resources, and then things like Kickstarter and other kind of crowdfunding platforms are also potential funding resources to help turn an idea into something that's actually a real product that's generating revenue.
I'm thinking of the program Shark Tank in my head right now. But and for those of you who are listening who don't know what this is, it's a TV show where inventors sort of pitch their product to sharks, investors, and try to convince them that there's going to be a return on their investment. But there must be a little bit of this actually going on when you're seeking money to develop products. Don't you have to show that it's marketable, that it can be manufactured at an affordable cost and all of that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I was vice chair of the Maine Angels for 4 years. So, and I was a venture capitalist earlier on in my career. Shark Tank is not how it actually works. And neither is – well, I was the host the first two seasons of Greenlight Maine, which is on Saturday nights, kind of Maine's version of Shark Tank. But for sure, you have to be able to show people that this is something that people want and it can be – you know, delivered to customers who are willing to pay at a lower cost than it takes to actually make it. And it turns out that's actually pretty hard to do. So a lot of inventors think that the hardest part is figuring out how to make the thing work, and that's about 5% of the problem. I don't know whether you're running into that now, but building an actual business around it is actually pretty hard too.
Well, I was going to ask then, Mac, where are you in this process?
Currently, we've been issued the patents and we've gone through, you know, we funded generally through sales. It was a slow word of mouth saying, hey, this got us to the next step in the development and the community that we worked with. As far as our customers, it's a huge word of mouth. Big industry, small community. And when people see something new that seems to prove itself, they want to share it and say, hey, let me try that. Let me destroy it. Let me play with it. Let me give you some feedback. And I think that's something that, you know, if you make something, get it out to the real people that are going to use it and save yourself a heap of time saying, I've made this 100% solution. We've got all angles. In reality, you did 70%. And waste your time to get, you know, you want to provide a good product, but when making that decision saying, let's do this and see what the people think is going to save time on the manufacturing, you know, when it comes to certain items. I mean, you want to be precise, but at the same time, let the people drive some of that development and say, you know what, I agree. Everybody's saying this zipper needs to not be here. It needs to be here. You know, and listen. And that worked for us.
Are you going to trade shows? Other than word of mouth, what can you do?
That's where I started. I had come up with the product, and we had literally filed for the patent the day before I got to the show. And it was the largest show. It's called SHOT Show in Las Vegas. And showed a guy who said, hey, I'll give you some space at my booth. That thing's awesome. I said, well, thank you. And here it goes, 4 days of saying the same thing and losing your voice but still being motivated about it. And you meet a lot of people and it starts to take off. You know, and I really think it is that calling people, showing people, explaining it to people. You know, when something's too difficult on a manual, you just want to show them and then let them do it. And it was pretty good.
Sean, is this a point, though, in an inventor's experience where they also – now have to be defensive of their product? So they come out with a product, somebody else sees it, and they think, oh, that would be a nice thing. I'll make my own version.
Yeah, there's sort of an interesting gap that can be created there where you have your application on file. You've protected something so that you can now disclose it the way that Mac would have at the SHOT Show, yet you don't actually have your patent yet. And it can be there are some ways, but it can be difficult to protect yourself in that window while your application is running through the process.
So you do have to pay attention. Maybe your attorney will help you with this maybe in the course of.
It's one of the things you definitely have to pay attention to the market. You need to watch who's out there. Sometimes there are ways that we can accelerate applications in order to move them forward more quickly. But it's something that once you go into the market, if you have got a good idea, it will get copied quickly.
And you just said something like that there's a part of this in this arc where you're keeping things close to the vest, right? You need to protect this until it's ready to launch in some way.
There's absolutely a period where you need to be very close to the vest, where you want to make sure that, you know, you have the appropriate – if you are going to disclose it to someone, maybe you need an engineer to help you with a piece. Maybe you need someone who's going to help you create a prototype. You need to make sure that you have the appropriate agreements in place to keep everything confidential and to make sure that you're not going to lose the ability to protect your invention down the road.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. The number to join the program is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Community Foundation, celebrating 35 years of investing in Maine communities. Learn more at mainecf.org. And Gnome Landscapes, dedicated to enhancing outdoor living in Maine with installation, design, masonry, and maintenance. GnomeLandscapes.com.
This week on Radiolab.
Very funny. What a funny idea.
Mr. Google thought that right in front of the homes, they should build a bus stop.
A bus stop. To nowhere. There's no bus coming.
No bus?
Never.
The story of how one nursing home used a bench and a lie to save their patients. I'm Jad Abumrad. Join me.
Join us for Radiolab tonight at 11. The second season of Maine Public Television's new high school quiz show, Maine, is now underway. The academic high school quiz show, testing Maine's brightest high school students, on math, science, history, Maine, culture events, and other topics. This year, the top 16 teams are competing on Maine Public Television to be the smartest in the state. When? Be watching Thursday evenings at 8. This week's contest pits Oceanside of Rockland against Berwick Academy. We hope you can join us and watch all the fun. We have complete information, what's involved, how schools can register for next year, all at mainepublic.org. Click on television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Inventors in Maine. With me in studio, Sean Sweeney, patent attorney with the firm Tredecum, Don Gooding, chief content officer for Four Colors, and Mac McIntyre, inventor and part owner of Martinson Industries. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining me on the line now is Randy Lord. He's with Amp Fins. Randy invented a fin that helps amputees to swim. Thanks for joining us, Randy. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about Amp Fins. What is it, and how did you come up with it?
Well, I lost my leg below the knee amputee in 1989, and I grew up down on Mount Desert Island, enjoyed swimming, but after the amputation, let's just say that it's not a good thing to do. And so my wife made a comment to me one day, said, I thought you liked the beach, and I said, yes. And she goes, well, why don't you? And I told her, walking in sand with a prosthetic leg isn't fun, and when you get into the water, you know, that's no fun either. So we started to see if we could make something, because there was nothing on the market back then as far as, you know, the Internet. It wasn't as evolved as it is today. And it took us about 15 years to develop this, to solve all the problems, why there was nothing on the market, and the few things that were on the market, why they didn't work up to a satisfactory level that everybody would be looking for.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind sharing some of those examples? Like, what were the problems?
Well, you have a lot of people, amputees that go swimming, they get what they call a swim leg, which is just basically a waterproof leg with an articulating foot, possibly. And it created a lot of leverage and chafing. And in the water, from my belief, a swim leg will get you to and from the water and make you look normal. But once you get in the water, there's basically zero performance. And if you want to get people in the water, you have to make it appealing for them. So we literally cut up hundreds of fins trying to figure out what we could do to make it work. And finally, we came across something, and I was at the lake here in East Grand up in Danforth, and I had a grin on my face. My wife says, it works that great. I says, I can't believe how well this works. So we took it from there. We went in and talked to a bunch of prosthetists and had them sign non-disclosure agreements so that it would be kept confidential. And they said that the design was so simplistic and so perfect that they wouldn't change anything. So from there, we went to another prosthetist who himself was an AK, Corey LaPlante from Northern Prosthetics and Orthotics up in Presque Isle. And eventually, we talked him into trying one. Well, that was all it took. Within a couple minutes in the pool, he said that he felt muscles that he forgot that he had. He didn't feel disabled any longer, and he said, I'm in. So right then and there, we knew we had something. So then we went to patent attorneys to, you know, keep the process going. It took quite a while, quite a bit of money, but it was well worth the effort.
And so how's the business going now?
It's just we're still at the starting stages in that we have given away literally, I don't know, 50 or 60 fins to have other amputees try them. To see, get feedback from them, and so far 100% love them. They just, they were so perfect, and they could feel total freedom while they were swimming. They actually work so well that for, like myself, a single amputee, single leg amputee, it actually makes the residual limb dominant over a normal leg wearing a fin, which is very profound in that now we know that it will give amputees a definite advantage in the water, even for scuba diving and everything else.
Interesting. Well, best of luck to that. It's an interesting story, and sounds like it's taking off. So thank you, Randy Lord, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Randy Lord is with the company Amp. And Don Gooding, you're familiar with the story.
Yes. Yeah, no, I first connected with Randy. I was looking in my email before December 2013. This does take an awfully long time, and I'm kind of reminded of the – I'll paraphrase Thomas Edison. You know, when he was trying to invent the incandescent light bulb, he said famously, you know, I didn't fail 10,000 times. I just learned 10,000 ways that it wouldn't work. And I think the persistence that Randy shows in doing this over a very long period of time is a good part of the process, because you don't figure it all out the first time. And whether it's doing it, you know, for yourself and then trying it with other people, you need that feedback, and then building a business, it all takes a long time. And persistence is really important to ultimately get your invention to be successful in the marketplace.
Mac, was there any point in the process where you sort of thought, I'm not sure I want to continue on with this?
I think there was a lot of, you know, bumps in the road where it was very frustrating, saying, how do we solve this problem, or who can help me? You know, it's finding those people out there, like manufacturers or, you know, people that are knowledgeable of the materials you're using. And I think it's a challenge to find that and try to explain it. And then what you inevitably will do, like if you told me 10 years ago I'd be sitting behind a sewing machine learning how to do this, and then show someone, say, can you do this but make it look good? You know, it's about sometimes picking up those things. And a lot of people, like, you want to encourage them to do, you know, a lot of people say, I have a good idea. Okay, and then they tell you the idea and say, that's a great idea. And then they say, I wish somebody would make something like this. Well, you're probably that somebody if you want it, and you're going to wait for it. Maybe it'll come, maybe it won't. And I think it's really about taking that first step. And if it is talking to, you know, someone who's done it before, or, you know, someone on the legal side of it, it's like, you know, if you have a good idea, it's never going to be a good idea if you don't take that first step towards getting it out there, you know. And that's kind of that Yankee ingenuity thing is for yourself. But at the same time, you know, necessity, other people need it too. And I think you need to take that first step and find the right people to assist you. And they're out there, obviously.
Yeah. Sean, as a patent attorney, do you have a sense of how many of these patents that are awarded result in a marketable product, or are they just patents that are held and a source of pride for the inventor?
I would say that they run on a continuum. There's a fair number that I sometimes refer to them as ego patents. They're patents that someone just gets because they would like a patent, and the product will never see the light of day. But there's a large number that do actually become patents, do become products. One of the things that we also see is that, you know, we've heard a lot about iterating your product. And one of the things that you will see is that there will be patents on initial products, and those may never see the light of day. But then there'll be downstream patents that are related, and those might be the ones that are truly valuable because they go to your commercial product.
All right, let's go to the phones to Aaron in Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Hi, Keith. Nice to be on the show. Don, I know you pretty well. I'm Aaron from Beachstone. And I just wondered if you could talk real quick about the difference for a lot of inventors between trade secrets and patents. And specifically, when you're down the road, as I am now, and talking with investment groups, the first question they always ask is, do you have any intellectual property wrapped around your business model? And then, you know, in the early days, I made that decision not to do that because of the fact that I didn't feel I had enough funds to defend it in case I was, you know, in the crosshairs of a major competitor. So I'll take my comments off the air, but just wonder if you could address some of those ideas.
Okay.
Thank you.
So there's a couple issues baked in there. One is, how important in general are patents to getting equity investors? And it depends a lot on the industry. In a consumer product, it tends to be less important. Brand and brand equity is more important. In medical devices and biopharmaceuticals, it's absolutely essential. And, you know, Aaron, your business kind of falls in the middle there. Trade secrets, the formula for Coca-Cola is probably the most famous trade secret, where it's never been patented, but they've kept it super secret, and that's given them an advantage over time. I'm sounding like a lawyer when I say it depends, but it does kind of depend as to whether or not you go to actually get a patent on your process to protect it, or whether you're trying to do something else to build up a long-term competitive advantage. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that.
Well, so I would say that when you're thinking about your trade secrets versus a patent, you need to ask yourself whether or not you actually are going to be able to keep your intellectual property secret. A lot of times people will look at the cost of a patent, think that they don't want to go that route. But the reality is that they have to disclose their invention, because it really is an invention, in order to make their business successful. And if you need to disclose it to the public, you're not going to be able to keep it as a trade secret.
Yeah. Aaron, did you hear that? I know you disappeared for a bit there.
Yeah, I was disconnected. I believe I caught the time-delayed version on the radio, yes.
Okay. All right. Well,
thank you very much.
Hope that answered the question. Yeah, thanks very much. Let's go to Ryan in Scarborough. Hi, Ryan.
Yeah, I was just wanted to see if you guys could touch on things like Invent Help, organizations or programs that are set up where someone can bring their idea and they'll help you, move forward with it. And I'll take my comments off the air. Just wanted to see if you guys could touch on that a little.
So what is Invent Help?
Well, there are lots of organizations, I'll say generically, that are set up to try to help entrepreneurs or inventors. I don't have any firsthand information about any of them. I will say that I cast a very skeptical eye on organizations that say, well, just pay me, $4,000 and I will help make your invention be worth millions. I think it's generally pretty hard to do that. I do remember that there was a crowdfunding platform that was trying to do essentially the same thing, and they folded. Taking an invention and making it a business success is simply hard work. And I don't know that there are any organizations that have done a really excellent, replicable way of doing that successfully.
Yeah, I'd add to that by saying that, this is the patent process is one that is going to take years. You're going to put a lot of resources into it, and you are going to want to make sure that you have a relationship with someone that is going to help you through some of those ups and downs and help make some of the connections that you need made. And I've always been somewhat skeptical of people that it seemed to just say, give us an upfront fee and we're going to make you succeed.
Is there any kind of operation that is looking to steal ideas? So in other words, they come to you and you say, look, I'll help you get this developed, and they give you all the details of what you want, and then they say, oh, this is probably not going to be anything, I can't help you, and then take it? I'm making this up, but I'm just wondering if such things have happened.
I would be surprised if they hadn't happened, but I am not aware of any specific instances.
Mm-hmm. Again, because the failure rate of new ideas is so high over time, that I can't see that you could have a sustainable business trying to go out and mm-hmm. steal people's ideas, because there are zillions of ideas. In Silicon Valley, the meme is that ideas are worthless, execution is everything. And that's probably a little extreme, but I just don't see how you could build a business stealing other people's ideas.
Is there any area in which most of the patent activity is happening? You mentioned, medical equipment or high tech, even household gadgets. Is there any realm where we're seeing most of the activity?
I think it's pretty broadly spread, and there are certainly major corporations who have their own departments, their own in-house attorneys, whose job it is to file lots and lots of patents. And they end up building an enormous portfolio of patents in these large corporations to kind of defend themselves. You probably have a...
Yeah, patents, they can all play different roles, which is important to note. And when you get to the large company stage, there are some that are there simply to protect themselves. There are others that they want to, enforce to make sure that no one else is going to come in on a key product of theirs. So the reasons that you might pursue a patent can be everything from trying to acquire investment to trying to keep competitors out of your space. And depending on which one you want to do will depend on how aggressive you're going to be with your patent portfolio.
Okay. Go ahead.
Just to chime in, the process takes so long that you really need to have a product that's going to be relevant by the time it's out there. You know, that if you invent something, it's awesome right now, it's great, but by the time it's evolved and gets there, it kind of looks old or it's not cool anymore or it's irrelevant, then you really need to gauge what's your tempo going to be, and constantly evolve. We can look at some of the toy stores that maybe could have done things to stay with people and stay with trends and do things, or you could look at some, even a sneaker that's made 10 years ago. Something visually just isn't there anymore, and I think it's really looking at the tempo of your development and getting out there that's important as well.
That's a good point. All right, we're going to take a quick break. A word about tomorrow's show. You can join host Jennifer Rooks for a discussion about the police shortage in Maine and how it's affecting communities. Email your comments and questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And the Portland Food Co-op, a community-owned market featuring a wide selection of local and organic products, open to everyone 7 days a week.
The head of civil rights at the Department of Health and Human Services says he's fighting for religious freedom. Advocates say he's doing something else altogether.
Director Severino presents himself as a civil rights lawyer. And what he has done is turn the idea of civil rights on its head.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, each weekday evening from 4 to 6:30.
On the next Speaking in Maine, we visit the League of Women Voters in Bangor.
So the question here is, do you agree or disagree? Hillary Clinton was treated fairly by the news media. Nobody believed that to be true. Nobody likes to play a game when the deck is stacked against you.
Shauna Seamus is a political science professor at Rutgers University, Camden. She shares her dissertation research, why millennials reject political careers, and why it matters. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
And Speaking in Maine coming up immediately after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what to do if you have an idea for an invention. With me today, Don Gooding. He advises entrepreneurs. Mac McIntyre, he's an inventor based in Portland. And Sean Sweeney is a patent attorney. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. An email from Glenn who asks, what are each of the guests' favorite inventions?
Favorite inventions. Wow.
Maybe we could limit it to main inventions. Anything that you've seen come across that you thought was particularly innovative or groundbreaking?
I'd say a snowblower at this point.
Yeah, right. My bean
pretty
boots.
Pretty happy when it starts.
Yeah. Interesting. Let's see. All right. Let's go to Helen. Helen writes, this Saturday there was a Maine Invention Convention for young inventors. Finalists will travel to Detroit in June to compete in the National Invention Convention Go Mainers. Don, is this a thing that we're trying to expose people to younger and younger, that is, to see the possibilities that inventing something is not within their grasp, I guess.
Absolutely. I believe Renee Kelly at the University of Maine is one of the people behind that program. And there have been efforts nationally to try to make young people feel like they can make things happen themselves. You see it in a lot of different contexts, also software coding. So it's definitely something to be encouraged so that students grow up thinking that, yes, they have the capabilities themselves to go out and do something. And you're also seeing entrepreneurship classes happening. I was just hearing today about how Falmouth this year is having a big entrepreneurship club, and there are entrepreneurship clubs springing up in high schools all over Maine. And so I think that's a very encouraging sign, because ultimately invention and entrepreneurship is how we are going to reinvent the economy here in Maine.
Yeah. So, Mac, you're working probably too early to ask you this, but are there other inventions that you're working on?
I'm working on a few, and now I've focused more on the same soft goods, you know, using materials, using fabrics and the same hardware. So I've kind of focused on that. So I have things where I want to evolve current products and then release some new things where I think it's a developing stage. You know, when you say kids are doing stuff that – you know, that whole being outside and playing and using tools and sticks and fabrics and strings and playing and arts and crafts and making sure that they're busy with just things or a hammer and a nail, that, you know, if you're so isolated, not constantly working with your hands and making things or doing activities that may require something to be invented, then I don't think you're going to really, you know, exhaust what's out there. So, yeah, I'm working on a couple of things that are more towards the civilian world. You know, my gear was designed – kind of evolved into a for the civilian, because, you know, it's a bulletproof vest in the end of the day. And, you know, I looked at it where, you know, here in Maine in boats, we have life jackets required to have them on there. And we don't have anything, our vehicles, to land jacket. So, you know, when you want to abandon your car, you want to grab something, even if it is a flashlight and a snack or a tent or something. But, you know, evolving into the more user-friendly, you know, the outdoor stuff, and just making it small batches but quality, and I really enjoy that.
So you're taking what you learned in this first arduous go-around to maybe come up with some other things that...
And I think it's a state of mind when you start to create and you get involved in it and solve problems and create problems, solve them, that you would naturally evolve into making new things that are much easier now to be a reality.
Rob asks, I have designed a proprietary alarm system using components from unbranded Chinese security devices imported from Alibaba. Am I able to patent what I've designed? I can't find a company to contact about it. Of course, you're not going to give legal advice, Sean, to Rob here, but in general.
Oh, in general, I'd say that it sounds like you might be at the stage where doing a patentability search is a good idea. So contacting a patent attorney to discuss your invention and figure out what the next steps might be sounds like where you're at.
Okay, good. And let's go to Henry in Cumberland. Hi, Henry. Welcome to the program. You're on the air.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
I've been involved in product development and design for over 30 years, and I've had a lot of inventors approach me about developing things, and they want to get a patent before they show me any aspects to it. Or, you know, they'll show it to me, but, you know, under an NDA. My question to them is, how deep are your pockets to defend that patent?
Mm-hmm.
Because in my experience on the corporate side of things, as well as, you know, I've been involved in medical device and a variety of other things, it's going to go away. It's going to be copied. And so if you want to go and get a patent, great, but are you willing to defend it?
Yeah, we talked
a lot of them at that point go, "What do you mean?" they're under the assumption that once they have the patent, it's, you know, they're protected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you do the law is written such that you do have to be vigorous in protecting your patents, right? Is that...
Well, the law doesn't require you to enforce your patent. It actually, you have the right to enforce it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to enforce it, but. I would say that while it is no small task to enforce your patent, I've represented small inventors who have had to sue very large companies in order to protect their patent rights, and have done so successfully. There are definitely ways that you can approach that process that put it within the reach of a small inventor, depending on how much they want to invest in it.
Mm. Do you have any stories of – I don't want to embarrass anyone or put them on the spot, but any stories of people who've had a seemingly good idea but just couldn't carry it out for all of the reasons that we've sort of talked about here today?
Well, I think that's pretty common actually. because, as I said earlier, the idea, the invention is only 5% of the problem. Actually building a business and marketing it, so one of the probably 200-year-old aphorisms is that if you build a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door. And a lot of inventors seem to have that notion that it's still true, but that was before modern marketing happened. And now everybody's assaulted with 3,000 messages a day from marketing. And so getting the word out about your great idea is actually one of the really harder things. So no matter how good your thing is, building the business is actually pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and the invention part is really just that first initial step, getting to functional manufacturing, being able to get to scale, doing the marketing, as Don's talking about. There are just so many downstream steps, and you need to be very committed. It's a long road.
Yeah. And Mac, in your case with Elsa, did you had an idea in your head. Did you make drawings of what this might look like, or did you make a prototype?
I did. I started drawings, and I had a drawing background, and then I made models of out of paper, tried to figure out how it was going to work, and then I got to took some old L.L. Bean backpacks and cut them up and Frankenstein them, sold them with dental floss and needle and thread, and then I'd set it down and come back a little while ago, and I was like, this thing's cool. I need to get this to work right. And then I, started putting it together. So it was really a, like I said, I didn't know that where it was going to lead to or where I was going. I eventually had to learn how a factory runs, learn how to make patterns, learn, how to source materials and then lots of materials and dyes and things. And it evolved from, hey, I just want this piece of equipment to work for me and other people liked it, to, buying sewing machines and doing lots and doing production runs and doing the marketing and then social media stuff. And it's been a process of, okay, well, it was kind of a natural gravitation for me because I like to make things and I like good gear that's going to last a while.
Were you being driven at that point, though? Because when you're moving into, buying sewing machines and learning to do this, I'm not going to say it's an obsession, but you're driven to complete this. Was that at a point where you knew it might become something, or you just really wanted to solve this problem?
I think it was seeing the excitement in some of my peers that were in the same industry and seeing it, said, this is really, this will work and I like it. And that's what was driving, and it's like, and then having, people want to knock it off or what have you. It's great because that's the biggest compliment, is saying, hey, they say an artist, somebody who steals your work is the greatest compliment. Well, ask a person how it feels, but in reality, if it's that good that people want it and you get to make it, and it was more driven by society and my community that liked it, and then that that fuels you to keep working and doing good things, and then someone will say, well, I'd like a custom one, and now you're motivated it for them to have their specific thing, and they say thank you, and it's very rewarding when it starts to build that machine of working together and meeting people. Like if I was a child and went to a factory on a field trip, it blew my mind as an adult, to see how they were cutting fabrics and how many machines were going and different things that were working, where it was like, it's exciting, to me and I think to other people. But if you've never seen it, you're like, this is impressive.
So Sean, when a person like Mac comes to you ready for applying for a patent, what are they coming into the office with? Are they coming in with a prototype, backpack made out of bits and pieces that they strung together? Is it a drawing? Is that actually an application that you require of them?
I would say anything and everything is the answer to that question. They some have prototypes, some have drawings, some have simply ideas in their head where they want to talk it through. People present at all different stages. And, what's important if you have a good idea and, you want to follow it through, is to follow it through. Have the conversations, find the right people that can help you protect your ideas, find the right people that can help you turn it into a business, and to continue taking those steps, because there are a lot of them. And so I never shy away from somebody who comes at me very early, because clearly they're vested in what they're doing, and as long as they take the steps, I'll take them with them.
I guess you have attorney-client privilege. You can't share examples of people. I'm trying to get at, though, if they're – anything stands out in your mind as an unusual request that came in?
I wouldn't say – I probably couldn't give away any unusual requests, but the things that people have come at me with are everything from simple mechanical devices that hold things together in a unique way right on up to fabrics that generate electricity. You know, it really it is a very wide range.
But you're not advising them on whether it's a marketable idea. You're just going to research whether there's any other fabric that can conduct or generates electricity.
My feeling is that at the stage when they're looking to get a patent, they don't actually have enough information yet to know whether it's going to be a successful commercial product. And so what I do is I try to help them figure out whether or not what they have is protectable. And then I try to make sure that they hear from me that it is critical that they figure out whether it's going to be marketable.
Yeah. Have you ever had anyone who's come to you multiple times who's just churning out ideas?
We were talking about the getting kids into inventorship, and inventing seems to be something that's absolutely infectious. There are very few people that invent one thing and stop there. So, yes.
it sounds like a lot of fun, but maybe the very first one is the big hump. And once you're through, it can be a lot of fun. Thank you all for being here today. Interesting conversation, and best of luck.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mac McIntyre is an inventor, and he's part owner and product developer at Martinson Industries in Portland. Sean Sweeney is a patent attorney with the law firm Tredecum. And Don Gooding, he is a chief content officer for Four Colors of Money for Entrepreneurs. John Keimel ran the board today. Owen Manahan answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the police shortage in Maine. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.